illuminating.
I think I would like to hear it. There's a lot of depth
about you and her. It's really revealed.
I think it just has to do with our small talk. Is
go eat all the tangy.
Pretty smart guys. And oh, hello there. It seems you've stumbled upon our humble podcast. You're listening to Know It All with Tay and Kay. My name is Tay.
I'm Kay.
And last week, we got into a bit of a heavy discussion about gravity, so we thought we'd take it a bit light. And this week on Tay and Kay, we're going to talk about
chess.
One of our favorite subjects. We are board game freaks here at Know It All with Tay and Kay. Even our producer, Logan, is currently playing game of chess right now on his computer. He seems very devoted to it.
He's also playing both sides.
And he's just rocking himself out. It's very impressive. Now, you might be asking yourself, normally I sit down and play a game of Sorry or Boggle or crossword puzzles if I'm bored, but what is this chess that you're speaking of?
Chess is a very classic game.
It's classy.
Uh-huh. Well, its origins go back to the Soviet Union or to Russia or to the USSR or whatever, the Byzantine Empire, whatever.
Whatever
it's
you might want to call it these days. We're going to stick with Russia just to be safe.
Chess started out, it was first devised by Tsar Bitsar. Mm-hmm. The game was made in order to settle land disputes between nobles.
You know, it eventually, however, it came to kind of encompass his entire domestic decision-making process.
He believed that the game held mystical divination properties similar to voodoo knuckle bones.
Or an animal sacrifice, where you examine its entrails to see what portents awaited you.
Sure, or how the Aztecs removed hearts.
Mm. Originally, the board was only 3x3, which was pretty tough, because it left players only 9 squares for movement.
The first pieces... given the social circumstances surrounding its creation, were the king, the bishop, and the knight.
But in such a small playing space, a single bishop, even, is really cumbersome to use, and in the original rules, a king couldn't mate a king directly.
So this naturally made the original game of chess uncompromisingly difficult, even more so when you consider that the pieces were live humans.
So simple decisions resulted in a direct loss of human life, and it really wasn't until the nobility's ranks began to, thin out a considerable degree that Tsar Bazar chose to use corn for the king, a grain of rice for the bishop, and a grain of the poorest grain, millet, to represent the knight.
Now, these early chess games lasted for a very long time, and the earliest masters of the game were those that could simply bring it to an end without killing their sons or brothers. These masters began in secret to develop more pieces, at first with just one or two squares at a time, and eventually leading to the 8x8 board we now know and love today.
Now, the 8x8 board is very interesting. It's a very classic-looking invention, and indeed, if you look in most Russian houses, we'll get to Russia later, if you look at most Russian houses, all of the floors are arranged in a black-white tile pattern, similar to a chessboard.
This is so that a game of chess can be sprung up at any time using things found in the house, such as
pot holders, egg beaters,
can of Pringles,
your friends, anything really.
Right.
It's a pretty interesting place, and they deeply love chess. But again, I want to just go over the rules of chess.
Yeah.
For those who may not be familiar with it.
Well, the goal of the game is for each player is trying to eliminate the other team's king by any means necessary. And in order to eliminate it, the king must be put in harm's way and unable to escape from it.
Now, the way that you do this is with a variety of assisting pieces with limited movement ranges. First of all, you have your pawns, which I mentioned. There's a row of 8 of them on the front of each side's board. They can move 1 space each and only attack diagonally.
Mm-hmm. That is, unless it's their first move, they can move 2 pieces.
They get really tired pretty quickly. They're pretty weak.
Yes. And then behind them, you have a row of
various other pieces with
higher classes of pieces, such as rooks, which move in straight lines, knights, which, as we mentioned, move in an L shape.
Well, kings, however, can only move 1 space in any direction, and the most powerful piece, contrary to what some of our more chauvinistic listeners may be thinking, is actually the queen.
The queen has a lot of power.
It's very deadly, very scary, and I am afraid of deploying my own queen very quite often, so I generally stick to working with my bishops, which can move diagonally in any direction for any length.
Yeah, sidestep. But bishops are slightly limited, because let's say your bishop starts on a black square.
It's only staying on black.
It's staying on black. A bishop cannot attack anything on a white square. It's just not going to happen.
Now, when you look at the game of chess, you're thinking, wow, this is going to be pretty boring. There must be some more fun, complicated things that you can do that can make the game more interesting. And you'd be right. You can do some pretty cool stuff with chess.
Yeah, well, the most basic derivative form of chess...
It's team chess.
Team chess.
It's a less popular form of the game of chess, and the rules are exactly the same, but each color is played by 2 to 10 people.
Yeah, depending. And team chess is... huge in Absolutely. Russia.
Just enormous. And it's even bled over into countries like Lithuania and Romania.
Mm-hmm.
It takes an enormous amount of patience and dedication to play a game.
Team chess games tend to last exponentially longer with the increasing number of players. So if a one-on-one game of chess would take an hour...
A 2-on-2 would take 4.
A 3-on-3 would take 9.
4-on-4 would take 16.
And so on and so on and so on. This is because there's no time limit to a standard game. It takes an incredible amount of trust and discussion in order to make a single move. In a game of team chess, each team is given one chair and one glass of water per player.
Every 10 hours, each team is given a 5-minute bathroom break. This is really where the stamina comes in.
Right, no food is allowed to be consumed within the frame of the game.
Players can sleep, but at least one player has to be awake at all times, which makes stuff a little tough. You can get a lot of awake players ganging up on one single awake player while the rest of his team's asleep, that kind of thing.
Or one team's awake players can disrupt the other team's sleep.
It's very tough, and a lot of people have a lot of trouble dealing with it. In order to have a well-rounded team, each player must be not only a great chess player, but a good communicator, a great listener.
A stable and reliable bladder and bowels, decent fat stores.
The game is actually outlawed in states, because it turns into kind of a competition to see who can deprive themselves of food and water longer than the other, rather than a competition to see who's better at chess. This usually lands people in the hospital, and sometimes even kills players during the game.
However, I think it is valid to bring up that were team chess legal,
like
then there
prostitution.
Would... Right, then there would be standards and regulations and properly compensated officials to oversee them and make sure that the game is played safely. But it's still illegal, even though dozens of underground teams die every year.
I still support its illegality. I think it's a bit of a blasphemous... version of chess. I'm not a big fan of it. However, it's, I can see that it has casual merits.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
I think it's about a good time to hear a word from our sponsors.
Absolutely. I'm Taylor. I host a podcast. And in order for me to get to work, I have to cross a river.
We noticed that people from all sides of the river had a desire, a need even, to cross the river.
Yeah, I'd usually take a ferry, which was $3 every time. It ran on a schedule, and it was slow, and it smelled.
One day, I was walking on opposite sides of a creek with my sweetheart.
On a nice day, I might kayak to work, which is nice, but it can kind of cause a whole host of problems.
I wanted to hold her so bad. I risked wet socks by hopping over some stones to get to her side of the creek, and that is when it hit me.
Thanks to the bridge, I can get across the river really... whenever I need to. It's super convenient, and it lights up really cool at night. Oh, and it has a partition between the road and the bike lane, which is good.
All around the world, people are falling in love with bridges. And why the fuck not? I mean, they're great. Bridges.
Chess has been around for a really long time.
Well, the reason for that... Well, there's really two reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
And one is because chess has accumulated... a really strong lore.
A big history. There's a lot of famous games, famous players, famous moves.
Yeah, legendary anecdotes, just similar to baseball.
That make it a sort of cultural phenomenon in its native Russia.
Right.
The other reason, I would say, personally, is because it's so simple.
It
we
is.
Just explain the moves to you in seconds.
Yeah, we just explained to you how to play it.
Yeah, you can even play it verbally. It's so simple if you're blind, for instance.
Yeah,
people play it by mail.
It's so simple that you can study chess for your entire life and still be beaten by a child.
Well, that's because children excel at chess because of their naivete to the world. Without having a mature understanding of the complexities of the working world and the grand scheme, like national economic stability, maritime law, down to the unending social complexities of small talk, you can't be fully distracted by frivolous games. As an adult, for example, I'm not very good at chess because I can't focus on the game because my mind is always focused on more important things, like my kids, my wife.
Interesting.
God, my career, my sick mother, my ailing father, my gouty mother-in-law, my tumorous father-in-law, my car, my dog, my country, my erectile dysfunction, my poor spelling and pronunciation, that maniac who speeds through my neighborhood, it's a residential area, there are kids playing for crying out loud, kids playing games like chess. Yeah, I just can't play chess. anymore because I'm physically incapable of relaxing my mind to the point that I can focus so intently on a game.
Which is normal for a healthy adult.
Right. This is why chess is often considered a sport. In order to remain and retain an almost obsessive, undisturbable, childlike focus on a recreational activity, one must mentally train as hard as a triathlete.
About one-third of the world's grandmasters practice Zen Buddhism, yoga, crossword puzzles, word and math puzzles, and are avid readers.
Another third of the world's grandmasters, however, are adults of varying ages who have lived privileged lives.
Yeah, privileged enough that they can retain a childlike focus because they have a lifelong wealth, which
has allowed them to avoid the responsibilities that create adulthood.
Right. They've avoided physical maturity.
This is not all rich people, we want to add, just the ones who are really good at chess.
The last third of chess grandmasters is, unsurprisingly, children.
The percentage would be higher, but grandmaster is a lifelong title, and children grow up too fast.
In fact, only about 10% of the world's grandmasters throughout the last 20th century were granted the title after their 20th birthday. The oldest person ever given the title of grandmaster was Russian-born Ivan Malchika,
which translates to man boy,
who was actually a feral child who grew up wandering the harsh, rugged Russian landscapes. He was, quote, rescued,
as they call it,
when an entire town of people bearing torches hunted down the boy, thinking he was some sort of poltergeist, haunting the town by night and stealing its pies by day.
So the townspeople, allegedly, this is just according to legend, ensnared him, only to find out that it wasn't a poltergeist or a Sasquatch. It wasn't even a Loch Ness monster, but a scared, lonely, hungry man-boy whom, judging by his beard, had been living alone in the cold Soviet woodlands for 24 years.
The townspeople choicelessly invited him to stay in one of the town's coziest holding cells while they figured out what to do with him.
So he'd never spoken before?
He'd never met a person before. He'd never communicated.
Just certainly. The animals and the trees. So he couldn't communicate in our traditional ways.
He was wild in the cell. Flailing. Drinking from the commode.
Attempting to eat pillows.
Howling.
Banging his head against the walls and bars. He seemed like an unstoppable cyclone of energy.
Supposedly. On the third night of his stay, the jailer approached him with a chessboard, and upon seeing it, Ivan's energy just disappeared, and all of his attention was brought to the board.
So the jailer showed Ivan the way the pieces worked with just, you know, simple visual gestures, which you can do, which is why it's so popular. And then, without a thought, he set the board down, and he began playing chess through the bars.
Ivan was terrible at first, opening poorly.
He exchanged rooks for knights.
And attempting to eat his opponent's pieces.
He quickly learned, however, that the most effective openings, how best to castle, and that if you choose to eat your own pieces,
which is allowed,
why to eat a bishop before a knight.
He learned at an incredible rate. By the fourth game, he had won for the first time, and by the seventh game, he could beat the jailer consistently in less than 10 moves.
Ivan would only stop playing chess to cyclonically tumble through his cell in violent protest of not having an opponent.
The townspeople were fascinated by the man-boy and his naive chess prowess,
so they did what any good Soviet would do and took him on the road, challenging well-to-dos and upper crusts to games of chess for shoes full of rice.
This eventually caught the attention of Grandmaster Miko Spassky, who invited him to Brovinko's, which I looked into. It's kind of a Russian version of Chuck E. Cheese, for his birthday party in what would turn into one of the legendary games of chess.
Spassky versus Manboy is one of those games that you can go back and recreate, and it will just make you feel like a kid again.
I can't read through the reams of moves without hearing the sounds of skee-ball and Street Fighter 2.
So, Manboy won the game when he, in a very ballsy, if I may say, move, took the offensive with his king. This upset more than just Spassky's so far totally awesome birthday party. His friends and family and fans were also upset by Spassky's ensuing temper tantrum and his coincidental pity party.
Manboy, on the other hand, was launched up the professional circuit, chess circuit, and attained the status of grandmaster in less than a year. Manboy soared to the top of the chess world, but upon his first loss after receiving the title of Grandmaster, Ivan flew into a rage, ate off part of his opponent's face,
as you are wont to do as a child,
and breaking two arms in the ensuing brawl, escaped through the back door and into the cold, unforgiving Soviet wilderness which he loved and longed for so much.
This was all back in 2007, and he's not been seen since. Some speculate whether he will ever return to the elite world of competitive chess. Now, Constable Gregor Hertzky, who knew Ivan better than anyone else, said that in that terrifying moment of checkmate, Ivan saw the distractions of maturity. For the first time, he found himself deeply thinking about his wife,
which he did not have,
his house,
which he did not live in,
and his job,
which he never held.
And he got scared and he ran, which apparently is a very graceful way for a grandmaster to leave the game. I imagine it's comparable to dying in battle. If you're listening to this podcast, you speak English, and if you speak English, you probably know enough about Bobby Fischer, but you don't know some of these more obscure facts that we're going to discuss with you today.
Now, he was a boy wonder.
He was one of the most beloved and hated and enigmatic figures in the history of chess. He filled the hearts of neighborhood hobos with love and admiration as he handily beat them at their games of super chess while revealing to them new and creative ways to fool passersby out of money.
He was a grandmaster and international superstar before the age of 18 and faded into obscurity shortly after. But his impact on chess is and its subsequent reemergence into American consciousness was so profound that a new piece was created just for him.
The Bobby Fischer. It moves just like this. Two Bobby Fischers are placed in the center of the board, each on their own color. They can occupy the same space as any other piece. You can move a piece on top of them if you'd like. Mm-hmm. And this is encouraged by their flat checker-like shape. At any time during the game, even out of turn, you or I, or, you know, any player, can declare Bobby Fischer and wipe the board clear of all pieces except the kings.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. The players must then rearrange all of the uncaptured pieces around the Bobby Fischers in a visually pleasing pattern. Whoever has the most attractive pattern is declared the, quote, checkmate, and gains an extra pawn.
Soviet players believe this to be decidedly unfair.
And it can be.
And it's forbidden in most tournament-level chess games. However, as the Kasparov Deep Blue match, which took place in Philadelphia, revealed, even seasoned chess professionals cannot resist the allure of shouting the boy's name in an attempt to extend their game against a fierce rival. But the Kasparov Deep Blue game was not the first instance of a man challenging a machine to a game of chess.
Oh, certainly not.
The earliest
was Samuel Crompton, if I'm not mistaken.
That is absolutely correct, Tay.
Oh,
proud of you.
Thank you.
The earliest recorded match of chess between man and machine was in Philadelphia in 1871, when local inventor / mathematician Samuel Crompton invented one of the earliest computers in history.
Mm.
The computer was the size of half of a city block,
had 1 million bilobytes of RAM,
and could only play chess. It took inventor Samuel Crompton and his three associates to operate the machine, which received information through an elaborate system of hand-operated pulleys and levers, which set in motion the thousands of calculations the machine would make before punching a hole in a small piece of parchment, describing to Crompton where to next move on the chessboard.
Each turn would take about 2.5 days for the machine to make. Nevertheless, Crompton found an opponent for his device. I would imagine it would be very tough to find somebody willing to wait 2 days between moves, but they found a very patient man.
Yes. Barthelemy Trevithick.
You've got a tough name to pronounce there. It's thick in your mouth.
I'm a little interested in where that name comes from. But anyway, he was a local chess peacemaker who Crompton assumed would be the best opponent in his town, considering the time and care he spent crafting each of his now highly coveted pieces.
And they were definitely right about that. Trevithick had an uncommonly deep understanding of each of the pieces on the board and their characteristics. I would imagine it came from him subtly caressing them and carving them and getting to know them and look deeply into their
eyes. I mean, he had an intimate relationship with all of them.
He just held them and cradled them in his hands, so he knew how to play chess.
The game between Barthelemy Trevithick and Samuel Crompton's chess-o-matic computer mechanism began on March 5th.
Lasted till November 18th with a stalemate.
Officials recorded that the Cromputer was up 2 pieces on Trevithick when the machine overheated and melted a hole 30 feet into the earth below. Despite Crompton's crew losing an accumulated 6 fingers, 2 toes, and acquiring 1 case of black lung from operating the machine, they were confident that had the fan not malfunctioned, the game most certainly would have gone to the machine.
I don't want to believe this, because as a human, I'm obliged to side with the humans. I think chess is becoming less of a competition between the rest of the world and the Soviets, and is now becoming more of a competition of man versus machine, which is why we found this story so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the melted ruins of this machine were stuck, melted into the earth for 20 years before being salvaged to make a large section of the Philadelphia rail system,
which still stands and runs today.
Crompton attempted to make another, better-playing chess machine, but he died shortly thereafter from lead poisoning.
Right.
I guess he wanted it to be super, super heavy. Not really sure why.
Trevithick, on the other hand, never played another game of chess ever. However, his authentic pieces
are really expensive
and very rare now. Most recently, at an auction, a full set of his pieces went for $1.8 million.
Yeah, Barthelemy Hot Hands Trevithick. Quite a man. Well, that took a little while, so we're going to let you relax while we take a word from our sponsors. You know, trees are for more than just toothpicks.
Really? Like what?
Well, lots of things. Here, I'll show you.
Taylor, what are we doing in this popsicle factory? You know I'm diabetic.
Oh, I just want to show you something. What's holding those popsicles wrecked?
No way.
Mm-hmm.
Wood?
Yeah.
Well, this could have come from anything.
But it came from a tree. Come on, I'm not done.
A public men's room? Mm-hmm. This is a bit ridiculous. Ah, man, my snakeskin boots are wet, and not a towel in sight.
Relax, Kevin. Here, use these.
Well, they're towels, but papery.
And where do you think that paper came from?
A tree.
You got it.
Wow, they're so much more useful than I ever thought.
Hold on. I'm not done.
Okay, my bowels are excavated. Where's the bidet?
Oh, no need, Kevin. Here, use this.
Huh. Oh, wow. This tree bark ain't half bad.
Oh, trees. More useful than you think. As I said before, the fight between man and machine is almost unending. It didn't stop with Samuel Crompton and his magical computers.
No, it just began there.
It really exploded into a human consciousness with the Terminator movies, which eventually inspired the creation of Deep Blue. Most people know Deep Blue as the giant chess-playing computer that played against Garry Kasparov in the mid-90s. Now, Kasparov was, like all Russians, an aggressive and fiercely competitive man with a penchant for drinking on the job, and fortunately, so thought Deep Blue, for Kasparov's job was chess. Now, Deep Blue is an anglicization of his real French name, Deep Bleu. Originally built to think up trivia questions for the popular Parisian game show Deep Bleu, fell victim to an internal error one evening, deleting most of his memory cache, save that devoted to board games.
Naturally, being a computer, he was incredibly adept at them and was frequently brought to Scrabble and Yahtzee tournaments as sort of a novelty act.
He was in many cases literally unbeatable, and it wasn't long before Kasparov heard tell of this wondrous chess-playing machine.
He decided to challenge it to a friendly game over lunch at his family's house. According to Kasparov, Deep Bleu was handily beaten in each game, but this is difficult to confirm.
It wasn't in Deep Blue's memory cache. As you know, he didn't really retain memories very well unless they were programmed in.
And Kasparov was known to be a belligerent man at times. Still is.
And a bit of a braggart. Now, having been taught in the Soviet tradition, Kasparov also usually played while belligerently drunk. None of his family ever attended matches or showed him the slightest support, as is Russian tradition.
Bleu and Garry played many casual games over the course of 1995.
The year of Windows 95.
But it wasn't until 1996 that IBM and the World Chess Confederation arranged the first official tournament of man versus machine.
Deep Bleu was a fierce player and had to be reprogrammed between matches in order to compensate for Kasparov's unpredictable genius.
Reprogrammed?
By humans.
Since the Bleu could not retain new information unless it was manually entered into his circuits, Kasparov simply changed his tactics with each game.
Bleu was still a difficult opponent.
Unlike most robots, he refused to surrender or accept a draw and had to be turned off as soon as he became conscious of his losses.
Because when he was turned back on in a safe location, he was livid, printing out ream after ream of what can really only be described as probably the most vulgar hexadecimal code ever put to punch card.
Kasparov defeated him 4-2. Only losing two because he chose not to show up.
The tournament lasted 6 days, one game per day, and Kasparov played the final game without even looking at the board. He was like an angry schoolmaster, immediately shouting his pieces' moves the moment his turn came, whereas Deep Bleu took up to half an hour between them.
Kasparov was, however, not so fortunate during the 1998...
The year of Windows 98.
...rematch.
Kasparov's skill was no match for a reprogrammed opponent, this time painted a fleshy and sexual pink.
Wet Rose, as she now preferred to be called, was a cunning opponent who preyed on Kasparov's psychological weaknesses.
She coyly sighed each time a move was made, and would print out what appeared to be love letters only to retract them moments before he got a good look.
This drove Kasparov mad, and he was drenched in sweat during each match.
Oh, he looked awful.
Yeah, the robot, reminded me of my wife at her most sadistically insatiable.
Unquote. I can only imagine what that relationship was like. Must have been tough, especially in Soviet Russia. Mm-hmm. The score ended up being 3.5 to 2.5 favor Wet Rose. The computer only offered a draw at the last one as an insult to a broken, weeping Kasparov. It's a true failure for the human race.
As we said before, chess is an enduring game. It's been around for nearly 2,000 years in one form or another, and it, in that time, has become so ingrained with not only American culture, but culture all around the world.
Now, the term checkmate, which derives from the chess term indicating the end of the game, when one player successfully locks the opposing player's king into an inescapable predicament, comes from the Russian phrase, shakimat. The term has transcended the game and has been utilized in films, literature, music, comic books.
Pretty much any medium of art, as sort of a rad thing to say when besting someone or predicting inevitable doom.
Now, poet laureate Jeff Goldblum famously used the term checkmate to describe the impending worldwide alien attack in the 1994 blockbuster Independence Day.
Shortly before the famous lines "E tu, Brute" from William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, upon being surrounded by his murderer, Caesar less famously declares, checkmate.
And, even in the apocryphal Gospel of Phil, which was left out of the Bible, he claims that Jesus, upon being raised on the cross, quote, looked into the sun and declared, checkmate.
Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev wrote in his autobiography, quote, each day that passed, I grew more and more irate with the insolence of the filthy Westerners. Several times per day, I perfected in my mind the fantastical scenario in which I, on the eve of nuclear winter, would pick up the hotline phone to President Kennedy's office, whisper, checkmate, and simply hang up, end quote.
Chess is pretty dangerous. Chess is very strange. The Russians really seem to like it. But one of my favorite things about chess is the hidden pieces that you don't really get to hear about very much.
Yeah, the challenge pieces.
These aren't technically allowed in most tournaments. I, however, prefer to use them quite a bit. My favorite piece, of course, is the snake.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I use that one all the time. It's my go-to late-game clincher. I often keep a small snake in my fanny pack in order to blind, stun, or simply frighten my opponent into conceding or calling a draw. And this is why I find playing against computers so unpleasant, because they just don't fear
the snake.
They're
impervious to the venom, too.
How's your bite doing, by the way?
That's okay, thanks. I'm glad that you had some gauze and some anti-venom.
It's looking pretty big.
Yeah, well, I read up on it. It should get big before it gets small.
Do you need me to suck out the poison again? I've got the jar full, but I can get a new one.
I'm pretty sure that you got all you could. Oh. I think it just needs to, you know, run its course now.
Yeah, it's mostly pus in that jar anyway. What about your favorite piece?
Oh, my favorite piece is without a doubt the quail.
Oh, yeah, the quail.
Which, if you don't know, can only be attained by getting four pawns to the other side of the board. It's very difficult to pull off, but well worth it. Now, the quail is unable to attack any pieces. However, at any time, it can move to any space on the board not occupied by another piece and lay an egg.
The next turn the quail is moved, the egg will hatch, and a random piece will be created in the space.
There's no limit to how many eggs a quail can lay, and the eggs can hatch pieces of both color, including hidden pieces such as the snake, the leper, and even other quails.
Wow, we aren't really allowed in most chess tournaments these days because of our prodigious use of quails and snakes, but I think we're both fierce opponents, and I think studying chess is really, for this podcast at least, has really only made us a much better set of players.
Yes, however, I still do have trouble, you know, pushing things aside to play the game, you know?
Yeah, it's tough. That's
why I prefer playing speed chess, because I mean, I can zone in and I can focus for 2 or 3 minutes at a time.
But for 2 or 3 hours, it's just really tough.
I also think that chess is just a more exciting game when it's played kind of on the...
in a passive manner, or in a very quick,
spurt. Right, yeah, very quick, sometimes a spur of the moment, very impulsive.
Yeah. Speaking of impulsive, I just had an impulse. I think... that's just about everything.
I think
we covered chess.
There's a little bit more to know about chess, but if you'd like to, you should just look it up yourself, because there's some fascinating stories out there. We just chose 3 or 4.
We just chose the ones that really stuck out the most to us as things that define our cultural perception.
But there are whole genres of classic literature devoted to the game of chess.
If you want,
especially around the Renaissance and the end of the Roman Empire.
If you want to get some good sports reading in, just go on Wikipedia and type in Russia versus the world or Soviet Union versus the world. It's a series of three chess tournaments during which Soviet players played, and I only skimmed the article, but I'm assuming literally everybody who was available to play in the entire world, and they trounced them.
Yeah.
So good reading. Just please do yourself a
favor. It'll also really make you think twice about the outcome of the Cold War.
Yeah.
So great, Taylor. I've got some good news for you.
Oh, wonderful.
We got someone to write in once again, and we've got some more listener mail.
It's fantastic.
So this today comes from Sean from White Springs, New York.
Hello, Sean.
He says, hey. It says, if gravity should attract me to the Earth, then how am I able to stay up here?
I'm looking at the letter right now, and it appears that he didn't bother to sign it. As quite the epistolary, I find this to be highly offensive. Just not signing a letter is extremely rude. And to be honest with you, Sean, I know you wanted to, you know, kind of rub our faces in our understanding of gravity, but to be quite blunt with you, if you don't have the dignity to sign a letter for us, I'm not going to have the dignity to give you anything but the rudest response possible.
Well said.
Thank you. Well, I guess that's about it. Please join us next week when we discuss current events.
This episode of Know It All with Tay and Kay was brought to you by Webster's Fictionary.